This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Your love's got me looking so crazy right now. Pop diva Beyoncé, head over heels in love with rapper Jay-Z. And there's the over-the-waterfall, supercharged rush of falling in love. Shakespeare knew it, Beyoncé knows it, chances are you do too. Now it's a matter of neuroscience. For the first time, researchers have located the region of the brain that an overpowering fall into romantic love lights up. It's not where sex lives in the brain or long-term love. The neural profile when you fall hard for someone is linked to the brain's profile in thirst or hunger or craving for a drug. Science is explaining a lot these days. Now it's cracking open the mystery of love itself, how it works, what it does to you, the chemical link between the lover and the stalker, love at first sight, and maybe a link to autism. Tonight on Point, the science of love and the deep biology of falling in, staying in, and falling out of love. You can join the conversation. Have you fallen hard in love? Did it feel like science to you? Did it feel like addiction, like thirst? Did it feel like chemistry deep in your brain? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Give us your falling in love story. Joining me now from Tecate, Mexico, is Lucy Brown, professor of neuroscience at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. She is co-author of the study Reward, Motivation, and Emotion Systems Associated with Early Stage Intense Romantic Love in the July issue of the Journal of Neurophysiology. Lucy Brown, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us from San Francisco is Arthur Aaron, professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He's also a co-author of the new study on the physiology of romantic love. Arthur Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst and love doctor supreme, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Dr. Beatty, glad you're in the house.
Hello, and hello to our guests. I'm here waiting for some heat in my ventral tegmental area.
I thought we talked about that, Jeff. We just can't use that language
okay,
on there.
All right. I'm sorry.
All right. It sounds like the setup for a joke. A neuroscientist, an anthropologist, and a social psychologist walk into a love shack and walk out telling the world they figured out what love does. Lucy Brown, what did you took 17 young people deep in the desperate throes of falling in love. You jammed them into MRI machines. And what did you find?
Well, we found several things. I think a lot of people ask me, what does this study explain? And the a very important thing is it helps to explain, certainly for me, those intense feelings of love that many, many of us have had. And one of the examples I like to talk about is from West Side Story. You know, and after Anita tells Maria that she should get rid of Tony, and she says, stick to your own kind, you know. A boy like that cannot love. Maria sings, I love him, I'm his, you know, I'm everything he is, not a thing I can do. You know, and the person who's in love experiences that. There's not a thing they can do. And why? And I think we've at least got, you know, some strong evidence to help explain why that is, because the circuits that are common to all of the 17 subjects that we studied when they looked at their loved one were very basic circuits that are involved, as I think was said near the beginning of the program, in things like in reward, basic reward functions that are very evolutionarily early reward systems. So that we interpreted this, that love is more like hunger or thirst, it helps us to understand people who are in love a little better, I think. You know, we can have more sympathy. You know, these people are driven. They have a goal. The other person is a goal for them.
And a desperate goal. Arthur Aaron, pick up the story on your research. What did you do here? You had young people who said they were in love, head over heels in love. You actually put them in a magnetic, was it, resonance imaging machine and took a lot of pictures of their brain. But what do you see when you take a picture of the brain of a person in love?
What we did is we selected people who were so in love that they could not stop thinking about their partner all day. They had to at least be thinking about them 80% of their waking hours.
How did you find these people? Did you track them down on the street? Did you see them walking in the mud puddles? What were they glowing?
Mostly we went to very large classes, 200-300 people, and we asked people who were very intensely in love to volunteer.
Step up, okay.
And then our collaborator, Helen Fisher, the anthropologist in the team from Rutgers, mm-hmm. she actually interviewed them. Along with one of my graduate students, Deb Mashek, at the time. And we screened out those who were the most intensely in love. Then we had them come to our lab and bring with them a picture of their beloved and a picture of someone of the same age and sex as their beloved with whom they were, at least as familiar
okay.
as their beloved.
Yeah.
We put them in the scanner, and we would show them a picture of their beloved for 30 seconds and then a picture of the neutral person for 30 seconds, back and forth like that. Now, we actually, in pilot testing, we learned that the problem is for people that are this intensely in love, they don't stop thinking about their beloved when they
can't even see the other one. It's just the loved one, the loved one, the loved one. And when you show them that loved one, what do you see?
Well, let me just say one other thing we did is in order to sort of clear the palate like a sorbet between courses,
right.
we had them count back by sevens from a very high number for about 30 seconds. Then when they looked at the neutral picture, for at least 30 seconds, their mind was clear.
Think about baseball.
Right.
Okay.
And so what happened is that when you look at what's going on in the brain during the 30 seconds they're looking at their beloved.
Yes.
And there's many repetitions of that.
Yeah.
Versus the 30 seconds when they're looking at the neutral person. There is substantially more activation, more neural activity as measured by blood flow. There's more neural activation in the areas associated with intense reward, like what happens when someone takes cocaine. And those areas are the caudate and the ventral tegmental area that you were talking about. It's a circuit that produces dopamine, which is this brain chemical that's so powerful in reward and drive.
The chemical of pleasure. But you didn't find this activity in the seat of sexual arousal. You didn't find it in the seat of emotional arousal. Am I right?
You want to talk?
Yes, please. Arthur.
Yes, that is right. We did not find it's known from other research what happens during sexual arousal. And those are very different areas of the brain than what happens during this intense, passionate love. As far as emotion, there's lots of emotion with passionate love, but it's not the same emotion for everybody. If you're passionately in love with someone and they've just told you they love you back, there's great happiness and ecstasy. On the other hand, if you're a little anxious about whether they really love you, you know, there's nothing more anxiety provoking. Or if they reject you or you're afraid they're going to reject you, there can be anger, there can be fear, there can be depression. So what we found was lots of emotion, but each subject had a different pattern of emotion. What was common across the subjects was this reward area.
And what does it mean that love, that falling in love, this is not all of love. There's long-term love is a different thing. We'll talk about it. Falling out of love, perhaps a different thing. But what does it mean that falling in love is located, the seat of that is the same place as thirst and hunger and maybe drug craving? What can we take away from that? Arthur Aaron.
Okay, Lucy, I thought might answer that one better than me.
Oh, well, let's turn to Lucy then in Mexico. Lucy, what do you say? What can we take away from the fact that it's here and not there?
Well, again, so I would like to hasten to add that, you know, there are, in each individual, there are many other areas of the brain that are activated when they look at the picture of their beloved. And the thing that's common is the activation of these areas that are involved in reward. And as you, so for
But here's my question, Lucy. What does it mean that love, the falling in love, is hooked in right there where thirst and hunger are? Does that line up with our sense of where love ought to be located in the brain? Does that tell us something about love we didn't know?
Well, what it does, I think, is it tells us how basic this is, you know, in evolution, and is an evolutionary strategy for our species, an evolutionary reproductive strategy for our species. Many people, I think, you know, and art certainly have thought that this is important, and Helen Fisher has thought that this is important, but this is additional evidence that it has been important. Some people would say, love was an invention of the medieval troubadours. I think this is additional evidence that, no, it really is an important part of our evolutionary reproductive strategy as humans. And we have variables, you know, many variable strategies, but because there's lust also, and you can accomplish, you know, reproduction that way. But that this is truly an important part of our lives.
Jack Beatty, what do you know? It wasn't made up by troubadours. It's a gift from our mammalian ancestors. It's Darwin talking.
Right. Thank you. That's a great way of saying it.
And it's found in every culture in the world.
Jack Beatty, what do you see?
Well, it
are
wasn't
you thirsty, Jack?
I am, but it was, but you know, evolution wasn't in John Keats's mind when he wrote, really reproducing that feeling, and he wrote, "And let me feel that warm breath here and there to spread a rapture in my very hair. Oh, the sweetness of the pain. Give me those lips again. Enough, enough. It is enough for me to dream of thee."
We've got a rapture in our very hair tonight. We're talking about the science of love. You can join the conversation. Did it feel like science to you? Did it feel like addiction, like thirst? Did it feel like chemistry in your brain? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
I often reminisce, I can't believe that I found a desire for true love floating around inside my soul, because my soul is cold. Half of me deserves to be this way until I'm old. The other half needs affection and joy, and the warmth created by a girl and a boy. I need love.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the science of love, about the neuroscientist's view of romance, about what's going on in the brain when you fall head over heels in love. I'm joined tonight from Tecate, Mexico, by Lucy Brown, professor of neuroscience at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, from San Francisco by Arthur Aaron, professor of psychology at State University of New York, Stony Brook. They are co-authors, two of the three, of Reward, Motivation, and Emotion Systems Associated with Early Stage Intense Romantic Love in the Journal of Neurophysiology. You won't find that on the Harlequin shelf. You can join the conversation tonight. The doctors are in. Give us your love story. How fast did you fall? How hard? How far did you think you were losing your mind? Do you want to understand swooning love as neuroscience? Or do you want to keep science out of the mystery of love? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stephanie's calling from Mineral Point, Wisconsin. Stephanie, are you in love? Stephanie, are you there? Stephanie's abandoned me. It's unrequited. Let's get another call here. Gabe is calling from Boston. Hi, Gabe. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? I'm a gay man, and I am very much in love, and I was wondering if your guests had studied any same-sex love situations, and if not, I'd like to volunteer.
What about it, Lucy Brown? Is it the same right across all sexual persuasions?
Well, we have not studied that, but my guess is yes. There's a little data about it, but my guess is yes. It's going to be this basic finding, at least, of these couple of areas that were involved, you know, in the students we looked at. Yes, this is going to be basic for everyone.
So falling, it doesn't depend on whether it's heterosexual, homosexual. It's the act. Arthur Aaron, you say that your research answers the historic question of whether love and sex are the same or different, and whether romantic passion is just warmed over sexual arousal. Explain that to us.
Well, one idea has always been sort of in the air that, indeed, one of my colleagues in social psychology, Ellen Verscheid, likes to say that passionate love is just 90% sexual desire unrequited, as yet unrequited. And it's a long-standing idea. And certainly people who feel passionate love also feel sexual desire, but often. But it's also true that people can feel sexual desire without feeling passionate love. And we know from just observing, people will commit suicide if someone doesn't reciprocate their love. They'll commit homicide. But they don't do that if someone won't go to bed with them, unless they love them.
Right.
Passionate love, it looks different. And yet it's been hard to sort out. And this is the first time we've had really clear evidence that's hard to come up with some alternative explanation for, that different areas of the brain, different brain systems are engaged by sexual arousal than what is engaged by passionate love.
And Arthur, explain this reward and motivation region of the brain to us. Describe what else is centered there, and what does it mean about love, that love is centered there? What really goes on here? You say romantic love looks more like the brass ring than a bouquet of roses, and I guess it's related to this reward motivation identity. What goes on there?
Well, it's
probably
that same...
Probably would rather that I answer that.
Sure. Lucy, yeah, actually, please.
Lucy Brown, before we even began this love research, was an expert, one of the world's experts in this caudate area.
Oh, well, then we want it. Give it to us from Mexico, Lucy.
Right. Well, one of the things that's so interesting about this area is that it's also associated with, say, what in neuroscience we call, you know, action bias, that this is a part of the brain that is involved in the planning of actions and movements. So no one has attempted to study emotion or something like love except for, say, the past 10 years or so in neuroscience. And something like movement is much easier to study and to measure, mainly. Anyway, so what we know about this area when we study movement, that it plays a big role at the unconscious level, which is important for all of this, by the way, for planning movements. So as a matter of fact, you know, when we are sitting and in love with someone, part of what we're doing is planning our actions around that person.
And you mean very simply movement, physical movement?
Right, sure.
Are we going to get closer? Are we going to stare at them?
Right, this part of the brain is probably involved, we're beginning to realize more and more, in the integration of movement, cognition, and emotion. That's probably one of its major roles. And as I said, we call it action bias, action planning, toward a goal, and learning, also learning, coming up with motor habits, too. It's involved in motor habits also.
Arthur Aaron, you've looked at love and behavior for a long time. How does it explain what you've seen over earlier years, that love is based in the same zone as thirst and hunger? How does that fit into your understanding of love? How does it help us understand our own feelings when we're in love, falling in love?
One of the controversies in my field for a long time in psychology has been what kind of thing is passionate love? Is it an emotion in its own right, like anger or fear or happiness? Or is it, as we've argued from other research, that it's a goal-oriented state? It's like the desire for a drug or the desire, strong desire for anything. And it can lead to diverse emotions according to what happens. And this study is pretty good evidence for the goal orientation point of view, the brass ring, as you put it. And what that tells us, especially in light of what Lucy was saying about how deeply rooted it is, how basic to the brain, how unconscious it is, when we're strongly in love, we have this intense desire. And it doesn't go away by trying to change how we feel. It goes away only very gradually by fulfilling that desire.
Fulfilling it, or, Jack, we've seen what happens when people can't fulfill that. When it's unrequited love, driven, as Arthur Aaron and Lucy Brown say, to suicide, sometimes to homicide, maybe to, you know, go off to the other side of the world, become a priest, live in the jungle, anything to get away from that passion.
From that rapture in our hair.
Yes. but
you know, equating it or finding it in the same area as these primal drives like hunger— really gives sort of medical backing to the metaphors about being a slave of passion, a slave of love, driven by it. And it also highlights, it really goes back to the Greek perception that love is a tragic business. There is the problem of requital. There is the problem of its fading. There is the problem of rejection. And it's like a candle that can be snuffed out. And the pain, once it's snuffed out, well, it can. I guess the doctors say it can be lit again. But once it's unlit, that is a that's a dangerous state for human beings.
And if I may, Arthur Aaron, why is the pain so great? Does the locus of love in the brain explain why the pain of unrequited love or lost love is so uniquely deep?
I think the most any time we have a desire, and on questionnaires, we'll ask people, you know, what does this mean? And they'll say, my life would be perfect if only this person could be my partner. It's this desire for merger with this other person. Mm. The fact it's so deeply rooted in the brain makes sense from an evolutionary point of view. After all, the sex drive makes us want to have sex with anyone, but passionate love focuses that attention on a single individual. And it focuses on incredibly powerful attention. There's very little in life that's as significant to us as the opportunity to be merged with another person. Intense love means just that. Here is someone I've seen that everything would be fulfilled if I can have them. And if you don't get that, what could be a greater loss? I mean, the only things that are comparable are people who, you know, have some, you know, tremendous opportunity, and then it's taken from them.
That desire for merger so deep, deeper, you write, more powerful than the sex drive, which is pretty famously powerful. Earl is calling from Boston. Hi, Earl. You're on the air. What's your story?
Hi. First of all, I'm pretty nervous talking about this, but basically my story is that there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that everything that your guests are saying is correct.
It feels like an addiction to you, Earl?
Well, it was. I'm married. I have a daughter. I'm extremely devoted to my family. A few years ago, I suddenly found myself head over heels in love with somebody else.
Another woman outside your marriage. Did you want that to happen?
I did not want it to happen. I managed to keep it from becoming a sexual relationship, but I was completely and totally obsessed with this person for quite some time, and was only able to stop by completely severing all contact with her and the environment in which we met.
It sounds like you felt that deep in the thrall of something beyond your control, something way down deep in the brain.
It was deep, and ending it was literally the most painful experience that I've ever had.
Did you feel incapable of sort of cranking it down, you know, that you were being driven by a thirst or a hunger beyond your conscious control?
In some ways, yeah. You know, I was able to set boundaries, but it was difficult. It was much more difficult than I would ever have imagined to keep those boundaries.
Earl, stick with us for a second. Arthur Aaron, speak to this story. Here's love that just moved in and took over, whether he was ready or not. Is this sequentially falling in love, you know, one time after another, part and parcel of where you find love?
Well, two things. One is, as I said, love is found, passionate love is found all over the world, but many, many cultures consider it a disruption to life, not a good thing, and for just this kind of reason. Mm. Thank heavens for our society and our cognitive processes. We can overcome deep drives, but it's very difficult. It's just like when you have a piece of chocolate, and it's really hard not to have another piece, even though you're on a diet. So this is very powerful. Now, there are also individual differences that come from early in life, and Helen Fisher and Lucy Brown and also Phil Shaver and Mario Michelinzer and some others.
Yes.
We've been looking at individual differences in how love works. And one of the things we know from behavioral research, some people are more prone to fall in love more often and more easily.
Because of their brain chemistry?
No. Well, because of their early child rearing, which presumably affects their brain chemistry.
And what might make them more likely to fall in love more easily?
Often inconsistent child rearing, a mother or a caregiver who was very responsive sometimes and unresponsive other times. It creates a kind of idealization and hope that makes these people more likely to fall in love and more likely to fall in unrequited love. We call them preoccupied individuals in the attachment literature.
Earl, how did this falling in love outside your marriage affect your long-term love relationship?
Well, it's been difficult. We've had a fairly difficult few years, but thank goodness we're still together.
And do you feel like you're free of the obsession now, or are you afraid if you got back within whiff of that perfume, it might be back?
I'd say that it shook me to the core. I think that I'm certainly free of this person. You know, it never happened any other time, and I hope it never happens again.
Well, you're very courageous, and you've overcome something that's enormously difficult. You should be very proud of yourself.
Earl, you've grappled with the deep cortex there. Thank you for sharing that with us. Lucy Brown, I hear you there.
I would just like to say another thing that I know something that Helen Fisher says, one way to view this too, and it can help, is when you're in the throes of this to realize that, as a matter of fact, she considers this a part of a biological imperative. Again, something we don't have that much control of, but it was advantageous during evolution for some people to, you know, mix their genes, for there to be diversity in the genetic pool and not to stick always just to one person. And even, you know, we look at some animals who are monogamous and birds and that kind of thing. But they all, although they appear to be monogamous and stick with one, they have these, they jump over across to other nests every now and then, and that this was advantageous during evolution. And that, in a sense, it's part of nature. We have to accept it and then deal with it, I think, as the caller just did. So it's great.
Helen Fisher, of course, the anthropologist, who's the third co-author here. But Lucy Brown, Helen speaks of love at first sight. Talk about dangerous or marvelous, depending on the circumstance, as a basic mammalian response. Explain that to us, Lucy.
Oh, I wish I could explain it. Anyway, so we are, as primates, just very visual animals. And probably putting together the face, the mannerisms of the person, and combining the inputs of memories of you know, people in our families, and maybe memories of first love, second loves, and that person happens to combine, again, at an unconscious level, many things that have been important to us.
Wow. Yes, Arthur.
I would just add, from the research we've done, the behavioral research on people's experiences falling in love, about 20-30% of the cases are at first meeting, not necessarily at first sight, but the situation, the most common falling in love situation, is you meet someone who is reasonably appropriate and for you, who is pretty desirable for all the reasons that Lucy was saying, and does something that you can interpret as indicating they like you. So you see someone that looks reasonably appropriate, they return your gaze or they come sit by you. Often people will say, at that moment, bang, it just takes off.
Jack Beatty, it sounds like a marauding army just ready to invade, and it goes deep when it comes on.
Oh, you know, I have so much respect for Earl, first of all, for his honesty and candor in sharing his experience that way, but also with what he had to struggle with. That's real human stuff. And, you know, there's a great poem by Tennyson about this called In Memoriam, and he ends it by saying, I feel it when I sorrow most, 'tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all.
But loved twice or thrice can put us in a heck of a bind, Jack.
Yes, it can, and it can make one sort of long for the sedater pleasures of marriage, of which Robert Browning wrote, come grow old with me, the best is yet to be.
Yeah, which sounds great until somebody knocks the door down and you're looking at that deep cortex.
I'm heading for South America.
What about longer-term love, Arthur, Lucy? Were you able to find that on the MRI scan? Have you looked at it yet? Arthur?
We look, you know, in our subjects, we had people ranging from about 1 month to about a year. We had one subject, I think, a year and a half. So we were able to look a little bit at what happens over that period of time. There's another study by Bartels and Zecchi in London that looked at people who were together about 2.5 years. So we can look at kind of a continuum. And what we see is that that intensity in the caudate ventral tegmental area circuit becomes somewhat less, and some other areas of the brain that we think from animal research are associated with bonding, with an attachment system, seem to become more active. But we don't really know yet. One of the studies we're starting to do is we're trying to locate people who've been together with a partner 10 or 20 years who are intensely in love with that person. We've started interviewing them, and we're hoping to do some scanning.
There'll be a lot of viewers for that. Lucy Brown, Arthur Aaron, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the science of love, the deep biology of falling in, staying in, falling out of love. What do you think? Are you in the throes of falling in love right now? Let's hear from you. We'll read your vital signs, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
I ask if Shad do it. Way to bring me Shad row in shallow shoals. English souls do it. Goldfish in the privacy of bowls do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the science of love, the neuroscientist's view of romance, of what's going on in the brain when you fall head over heels in love. What do you think? Does it feel like science to you? And what passage from literature would seem to support this science or contradict it? Let's hear your story. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Tecate, Mexico, by Lucy Brown, professor of neuroscience at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And Arthur Aaron is with us from San Francisco, professor of psychology at State University of New York at Stony Brook. They're co-authors of this big new report, Breakthrough Research on Where Falling in Love Lives in the Mind. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Vikas is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Vikas. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great.
Hi.
Program tonight.
Great.
I want to talk a little bit about my own love story.
Let's hear it.
I'm from Bombay, India, and I fleetingly met this beautiful girl while working there.
Yeah.
And then a few months after that, I came to grad school in Chicago, but I was constantly thinking of her, and I was, like, I think, passionately in love with her. And there were multiple problems in this. First of all, there was distance between Chicago and Bombay.
That's a long way.
Yeah, and secondly, I wasn't even sure if she was in love with me. But I kept the relationship alive a little bit by calling her up, sending her emails. And about 6 months before I was supposed to go back to India, we decided to meet up. And I thought that it would be a good idea if I send her my picture. And for 26 years of my life, I've had a little bit of weight problem. I've been on the heavier side.
Okay.
And she's a very pretty woman. And she saw that picture, and she just, in passing remarks, she just mentioned that, you know, I look to be a little bit on the heavier side.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, I was so madly in love with her that I thought that if this is the reason that I might not get her, in 6 months, what I could not achieve in 26 years, in 6 months, I lost 45 pounds. I used to go
Wow.
every day on Chicago's lakeside.
But 45 pounds, so love may be sitting in the seat of hunger, but it trumped hunger in your case. Because...
Yeah, and on top of it, there was another problem. She's a Catholic and I'm a Hindu, and in India, it's not easy to cross the religious divide.
So you've got to give us the bottom line here. Did it work out?
We've been married for 2.5 years now, and she's here with me in the U.S., and we couldn't have been happier.
And what happened to that blazing bonfire of falling in love? Is it still there or something different now, Vikas?
It's still there. It's more mature, but we are still madly in love. As luck would have it, she's actually now in Chicago going to grad school, and I'm working in Madison, Wisconsin.
That sounds manageable compared to Chicago, Bombay.
Yeah, it's much more manageable, and when we meet up on weekends or any time, it's everything is still there. It still feels like as if it's unbelievable that we conquered everything. But I guess, like you would say, love conquers it all.
And are you a Catholic now, or is she a Hindu, or are you just stayed right where you were?
We had two different weddings. We had a Hindu ceremony and we had a Catholic ceremony. And she's a Catholic, and I'm a Hindu. I go to church with her. She goes to temple with me, and it's great.
That's great. Love conquers all. Vikas, thanks for your story. Arthur Aaron, there, 45 pounds dropped in the bat of an eye.
That's terrific. That's one of the good outcomes of love. There's many good outcomes. I was saying we're starting to do research on people, and there are a lot of people. I mean, it's a small percentage, but there are people who've been together 10, 20, 30 years who report being very intensely in love. In fact, if there's anyone listening in the New York or Long Island area who would like to be in our research, please call my lab, 631-632-9601. We'd love to interview you. Bianca Acevedo, my graduate student, and Greg Strong, who worked on this study. We want to be on your show again, Tom, in a couple of years, telling you what it looks like in the brain to be in love after 10 years.
With high flame, long-term love. Let's get another story. Karen's calling from Boston. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, thank you.
Sure. What's on your mind? What's your story, Karen?
The person I'm in love with and I are both widowed, and we fell in love very intensely. We've been together about a year and a half, and I wondered about, even biologically, the depletion in those pleasure centers and now the fulfillment. It feels like coming alive again. It's so amazing and wonderful and so intense.
Karen, may I ask you, how long had you each been widowed before you fell in love with one another?
He'd been widowed 9 years. I've been widowed 3 years.
And
we were both very happily married.
So you had been, so you'd been deeply in love before.
We'd both been deeply in love before, and we'd not experienced, we were both married only a couple of years, so we'd not experienced whatever happens, who knows, over the long term.
And do you feel like this experience of love, on the other side of that terrible loss, does it feel different from the first time?
It does feel different. It feels like the intensity, and yet every second is precious. And I just asked him yesterday, I wonder if we'll ever take it for granted.
Wow. It's a great story. Lucy Brown, do you think that love after the loss of love, in neurological terms, would it be different? Might it be deeper? Are neural pathways shaped by the loss of a love in a way that might affect the way the next love is constructed?
Certainly. Our brains are changing all the time, and the past experience and loss can heighten then, you know, your second experience of love. It's very likely. And one of the things that was interesting about our study that was extremely interesting to me was that we were able to detect that even in people in love, you know, in their first or second or whatever, in their experience of love, over time, there were changes in the brain. So people who had been in love for, say, 17 months versus 2 months, you could see particular areas of the brain where there were changes. Maybe it was familiarity. We're not quite sure what it was. But certainly that the brain is keeping track, you know, of the length of the relationship and changing. There are changes going on that way. The brain is very dynamic. And I'm sure that these two people who were widowed, you know, came together with slightly different brains, and who knows quite the reason why it's such a nice, intense experience now for them. It's different people for one thing. They're older. I think in cortical regions or in kind of higher cognitive regions, I think there will be differences in brain activity of people in love depending upon their age also.
Jack Beatty, it's amazing to think that we sit on top of or are driven by this incredible supercomputer that on the one hand is adapting to our every experience, as Lucy Brown says. On the other hand, as she said earlier, that ties us all the way back to our mammalian ancestors. I mean, we've got ancient evolution and last year's loss or victory all sort of programming us here.
Yes, and, you know, what worries me about this is I have a sort of shades of Aldous Huxley here. If they can find where this miracle happens, and they can, they have, someone's going to come up with a pill. Someone's going to come up with
cocaine.
A machine.
Well, I guess that's right.
But you mean
you take this pill. Drugs that will activate that area.
No, so can you give two people a pill, I don't know, Vilovgra, and put them in a room, and they're going to be in love 5 minutes later? Arthur, is that what you're saying?
Actually, if you create strong physiological arousal and you put a person with someone else that's appropriate to fall in love with, they're much more likely to be attracted to them. We've known that for about 20 years.
The story of going through trauma together and coming out on the other side in love.
Trauma or something wonderful, any intense experience shared with another person, if the person is appropriate for you to be in love with, you're much more likely to fall in love than under other circumstances.
And what about this, Arthur? You write, you have findings here or speculation about the link between the lover and the stalker. Now, what's the continuum there?
Well, you have this very intense desire. and you'll do anything to fulfill it. It trumps, as you were saying, it trumps hunger. It trumps the laws of, it doesn't trump the laws of nature, but it certainly trumps the laws of society.
Yeah.
And you'll do whatever you have to do.
And if it's unrequited, does that, I mean, who tips over into the stalker? Does that get back to this, Lucy, does that get back to this sort of predisposition we were talking about before? Are some people, if they can't have the love they want, so neurologically poised that they're going to become a stalker, they can't help themselves?
All right. Well, yes, that's very much the way I would see it and say that there are neural circuits that can become overactive in some people and lead to an obsession with another person. And we certainly don't know the reasons why that happens, but it's certainly possible, and that the circuits we've identified may be part of that system that leads to stalking. That's what I would speculate.
Certainly. That's certainly deep. Alice is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Alice. You're on the air. What's your story, my friend?
I feel like I'm a pretty rational person,
okay.
And I'm someone who's never believed in love at first sight.
Mm-hmm.
As a consequence,
okay.
And I had that happen to me 2 years ago, very unexpectedly.
What happened?
Well, I was at a social function, and I saw someone, and just bam, immediately. I feel like a pretty reserved person, sexually conservative. I immediately, you know, just wanted to be with that person.
Was it because of the way that person looked? Was it the way they dressed? Or was it something you couldn't even put your finger on?
It was looks. And I'm not someone, it's funny because I get hit on a lot. I get lots of attention from men, and usually I turn it down. I would say 90% of the time, and no one really interests me. Maybe 5 people in my life.
So, was this the best-looking guy you've ever seen, or just?
It wasn't all looks. It was mannerisms. It was uniqueness. It was his role in society, and I feel overwhelmed because it's been 2 years, and I still think of this person, and I occasionally see him.
Yeah.
And
wait, you didn't follow up on this?
Well, no, I did meet him, and we spoke, and we don't have, like, a relationship because we live, well, for one thing, we live many states apart, but...
But you fell in love with him in that instant,
yeah,
and you still
feel
it.
I did, and I'm frustrated because I didn't believe in love at first sight, but I still, 2 years later, think of this person and wish that I could be with this person.
Ooh, this requires a consultation. Arthur Aaron, what do you say? How does Alice, she's in a predicament here. What's your consult, doctor?
It's very difficult. I mean, obviously, what people tell us, we're asking people about how they, recently we've been doing some research asking people about how they try to, we call down-regulate passionate love. And Bianca Acevedo, James Gross, mm-hmm. and I have been looking at this. And what people say they do is they just try to distract themselves, not think about the person, not be involved with the person. And that seems to help them. But we don't have any systematic research on how people can cope with being in love with someone that they don't want to work out for one reason or another, because it's not practical or because they're in another relationship.
Alice, we wish you luck with that. Lucy, our time is short, but I want to ask about this link at the other side to autism that you speculate about in this paper, between this seed of love and autism. What's the connection?
Oh, the connection is the idea that we do need systems to be working at a certain level, or we need certain connections in the brain to be made, say, during development, both in utero and in early life. We need these particular systems in order to form attachments. Now, in fact, some people who are autistic can form attachments, but many do not and can't even look another person in the eye, and they find it very difficult to look at a face. Remember, we use the face as the important stimulus.
Right.
So,
and you're saying because the neurology is just not in place for that in these
right.
individuals.
Right, and that possibly some of the areas that we're identifying are areas we can look at more carefully in people who are autistic and don't form these relationships, if they cared.
Jack Beatty, we're almost out of time here.
It's an
amazing
more understanding. No. You know, is it a neurotransmitter? Is it this particular system? Is it four differences? I mean, it will help us. I think in the long run, it will help us to understand that part of autism.
Jack, here's an incredible spectrum from a stalker at the one hand, autism at the other hand, and in the middle, most of humanity, this subject to this deep primal seats of love.
Yes, Dr. Brown says our findings don't diminish the magic in any way, and John Donne would agree. His from Love's Alchemy. Some say that some that have deeper digged Love's mind than I say where his centric happiness doth lie. I have lived and got and told, but should I love, get, tell, till I were old, I should not find that hidden mystery.
Dr. Love, Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us. Lucy Brown at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and Arthur Aaron at State University of New York at Stony Brook, thanks so much for being with us. The study is in the July issue of the Journal of Neurophysiology. In a moment, America crowns its newest spelling champion. This is On Point. Anurag Kashyap claimed the crown as the country's top speller earlier today, winning the 78th annual Scripps National Spelling Bee in Washington, D.C. The 13-year-old eighth grader from the San Diego area correctly spelled such words as Scheflera and Tristakeus on his way to the final round, and then he took home the championship with Appoggiatura.
Appoggiatura.
Definition.
An accessory embellishing note or tone preceding an essential melodic note or tone and usually written as a note of smaller size.
Appoggiatura, language of origin.
Latin to Italian.
Appoggiatura. Appoggiatura. A-P-P-O-G-G-I-A-T-U-R-A.
Afterward, Kashyap took questions from the press and shared some of his secrets of spelling success.
Do you have a coach or other classmates that help?
I got quizzed by my friends online on Instant Messenger. That played a key role. There were lots of good words that came out of there that were undisputed. And then the other half was independent study and not really parent involvement. They supported me morally, and that's all they could do, and that's all I could ask.
Anything you would like to say to all the kids out there across America who would maybe hope to sit in the chair that you sit someday?
Keep trying. If you miss a word, don't worry about it. This competition is a game of perseverance, and if you must keep trying, keep studying, keep reading, but also have fun, because this competition wouldn't be anything without the camaraderie and friendship that I think is one of the best parts.
Sounds like you made some friends out there this week. Any other questions? Are you glad it's over?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And no, because this is my last year, and I'll miss it so much. But no more studying, so that's good.
Congratulations.
Anurag Kashyap, this year's winner today of the National Spelling Bee. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.